This is episode 101 of The Variety Artist. This is John Abrams, your host and that guy that interviews successful variety artists from around the world every single week. This is the first show of my second 100 episodes. Last week was number 100, and today is episode 101. Hopefully by now you've joined my Facebook page, shopped at the Variety Artist store, and been reading those recommended books. Together we're creating an entire community of variety artists. Glad you're here. Okay, today's show. Imagine leaving your entire home and career and moving to a foreign land. Imagine using your performing art to change the culture of an entire country. Imagine the ways your life would change if that were possible. Well, it is possible, and that's exactly what my guest has done. You're about to hear a fascinating story of a puppeteer who's using his talents to save lives and really make a difference. And if you like what you hear, and I know you will, make sure to visit his website at projecthandup.org for more info. Enjoy the show.
Fun fact number 747. John has watched every single Twilight Zone.
Welcome to The Variety Artist, providing aspiring artists and entertainers with in-depth discussions from top performers from all over the world. So get ready to book some gigs, make some money, and have some fun with your host, John Abrams.
His mission to teach East Africans about living productive, healthy lives and prevent the spread of HIV by using novel performance and visual art educational presentations. His organization, Project Hand Up, uses puppetry, magic, and storytelling to educate and promote social change in developing world countries. Variety Artist, I give you Darren Collins.
Hello, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Darren?
I really am. I'm glad to talk to you. It's great.
Where am I talking to you from?
I'm in Nairobi right now. I'm in Nairobi, Kenya, and I'm sitting in Kilimani, which is a little suburb of Nairobi, kind of a nice neighborhood with bad sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
And every day I commute to my home right on the edge of the Nairobi National Park.
Oh, is it beautiful there?
Yeah. You know, I grew up next to the Olympic National Park in the foothills in Washington State in Port Angeles. And now I live almost the same distance from the Nairobi National Park as I did from the National Park back in the Olympics. It's really cool. I've always had this great view since I was a kid. I watched The Lion King last night and I was like, I know all these animals. I know all these landscapes. They're right in front of me. In fact, we had lions on our property like 3 weeks ago and they killed three of our pigs.
Oh no.
And they were eating the pigs just about 30 meters, 90 feet. I'm still American. Yeah. I don't use the metric system well, but about 30 meters from my house, I could hear them chewing the pigs. And I shined my light and I made eye contact with a wild lion next to my house for the first time.
Wow.
It was really, really impactful. I can't describe how exactly awful and wonderful that experience was. But yeah, eye to eye with a lion about 3 weeks ago. Yeah, it's intense, man.
That's very strange. I mean, on one side, you're like, wow, I saw a lion. But on the other side, you're like, wait, he's eating my pigs.
And they killed a guy two months ago. Just about a mile from my house. They got a guy at like 1 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, that we're on full alert.
Wow. Right now. So is that one of the reasons we're doing this this podcast, this interview? So at this time?
Yeah, it's basically an early memorial for me, just to have it on record what my life is all about.
Just in case you're not around tomorrow, is that what you're saying?
There's a real good chance. And, you know, the locals are always like, aren't you scared? And I'm like, well, I don't actually think they want to eat people as much as they want to eat pigs.
Yeah.
It's like the old joke. I don't have to outrun the bear. I have to outrun you. As long as the pig tastes better than I do, I think.
That's right. And as long as you're not walking home with a bag of pork rinds in your hands, you're probably okay.
Yes.
So what is Project Hand Up?
Oh, we don't want to talk about animals for a while? Oh,
no, we can if you want. I mean, we can talk more about that if you
Sorry.
Want.
Sorry, I got on a tangent there.
Let's get this name straight, because I know I messed it up a couple of times. It's Project Hand Up, right? No plural, no nothing.
Absolutely. It's a terrible acronym, which is like Healthy Africa New Directive Using Puppets, which we never use, but that was the thought. It's also a call to action. Like, if you will promise to treat a child born with HIV with dignity and respect, please put your hand up. It's also philosophical, like, don't give people a handout, give them a hand up.
Oh, there you go.
But that's the idea. It's singular. Project Hand Up. It's not like hands up. This is a robbery. It's not like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something completely different. Project Hands Up.
Oh, and it's symbolic for doing puppetry. You literally put your hand up.
Oh, that is true for puppetry, huh?
Yeah. That's the idea.
Now, you started out as a puppeteer. Is that right?
Yeah, man. I was like 13 years old and I was invited to a church puppet team practice. And I went and I loved it. My big brother is 16 years older than me. And he sent me a box of puppets when I was like 12. And I got really excited because he was really into the Muppets. And my brother had sent an audio tape to the Jim Henson Company, mm-hmm. then went off to college. Well, when he went off to college, he actually got a letter back saying, hey, we like it. Come audition. But mom and dad thought it was the Muppet fan club mailing list. Yeah. So they didn't forward the letter to him because they just thought it was another Muppet fan club letter. So he never got the message. So he never auditioned for the Muppets and never went to New York and gave up on his puppetry dreams. And then in his late 20s, he sent me this box of all this cool stuff. So I just fell in love with puppets because it was the only gift I ever got from my big brother was this giant box of puppets and Muppet memorabilia and that sort of thing. And so that sort of got me going and I started puppetry. And
I guess you could thank your brother for this entire project, huh? In a strange roundabout way.
Yeah, my life is sort of like my brother's life, what he wishes it would have been, I suppose. Because he wanted to do all the things that I'm doing. But Project Hand Up is basically, it's my life's work now. And it's really this great thing. You know, I did puppetry when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then when I turned 19, I got a job with Puppet Productions. Those are the guys who make puppets. And I was one of their traveling trainers. That was my first job, was going from city to city. I went to maybe 120 cities a year, about 200 miles a day, teaching puppetry workshops for church workers and cops and firemen on how to use puppetry for education. Mm-hmm. And that was my thing. And so I did one tour, and usually it was like a gap year thing for guys. And so I was like, well, can I do a gap year again? Because I'm not going to school as far as I know. So I went and did this tour several years in a row. And then finally I ended up getting a job right there at the company. Now they're a manufacturing company. So their deal was like, they were trying to sell puppets by teaching people how to use puppets. Mm-hmm. That was their sales technique. I was their sales force. But then once I got into the office, I was literally the youngest person there by 20 years or so. When they would get calls for people asking for free puppets, I would field those calls, and if it sounded interesting, I would send those calls over to the owner. And the owner really was altruistic. He loved to give away puppets. And, you know, they were doing like $2 million a year selling puppets. They made the McGruff the Crime Dog puppet as well.
Oh, yeah.
And all the McGruff the Crime Dog programming was written out of those offices there. The boss would just come to me into my office and say, hey, we're giving away some puppets. I want you to go to Colombia. Like, oh, okay. Or he'd walk in and say, oh, Darren, I want you to go to Cuba, or I want you to go to Cambodia. Wow. Oh, Darren, I want you to go to China. Like basically dangerous places that start with a letter C.
Places he didn't want to go.
Yeah. I never went to Canada. He didn't like the idea of anyone having his product without them being trained really well. And since I was kind of the trainer who was on site, I was always going to these places. Mm-hmm. And so in that process, I got this interesting call one time from Cambodia. There was a chemist who was tasked with doing waterborne illness and water purification systems. And one of the first like missionaries allowed into the country after the Civil War sort of died down. This guy was developing and streamlining the technology to do water purification with the clay pots. And he wrote the template for the World Health Organization. And he had also developed an ultraviolet method of water purification. But he called us and said, I want some puppets. And I was like, why do you want puppets? You're a scientist, you know? Yeah. And he said, well, you can have a problem and you can have the technology to solve the problem. But if you don't have education to sort of bridge that gap between the problem and the technological solution, it's useless. I mean, people will use a dirty bucket to put clean water in.
Yeah.
And what we've seen is that storytelling and puppets can allow us a lot of attention. People have rapt attention when they see things like this. And talking about diarrhea is not okay. But with a puppet as sort of a proxy, you can parse those taboos and say things you couldn't normally say. And it really holds attention better than a lecture or a flip chart or whatever. And I was like, that's amazing. So I called my boss and said, hey, you got to give this guy some puppets. And he said, yes, we do. And that was in 1999. And I was already going to Singapore to do some training. He said, stop in Cambodia. You're going to Cambodia. So I went there maybe six times over the course of the next decade because I loved that work. That was a really cool thing because after I stopped doing puppetry for that company, I continued to go to Cambodia because I ended up doing my own, starting my own career of just being a juggler and a puppeteer and a magician and doing school assemblies and that sort of thing. So I was, you know, a variety entertainer. And
yeah,
like the rest of us, you know, audiences between 500 and 1500 people, families, hey, Darren, you've got an hour. That was my thing. I could entertain a family for an hour, but I still loved going to Cambodia and doing this because it really made me think, man, this has a higher sort of purpose. Like you could actually use this method of edutainment, like all of us variety artists do really well. And so anyway, but I was fascinated that it was so tangible. Like this is literally life and death. This is like, we're talking about arsenicosis. We're talking about people where one in three children were dying of preventable waterborne illness in this country at the time. And so we saw real results. We saw people like life expectancy changing. And what was really cool to me is that he used the puppeteers. They would go out in teams of three, just like I used to do for puppet productions and their tours. They'd go out in teams of three, but he would also give them a water test kit and a GPS locator and say, when you do your show, and you tell everybody about waterborne illness and what to do and this sort of thing. Then ask them, where do you get your water? Hey, everyone. Where are you getting your water? Is it from a well? Is it from surface water? Is it groundwater? Is it rainwater? Show us the site. And so the people who just saw a great puppet show would like, oh yeah, of course, we get our water over here, they'd plot the GPS and they'd grab the water sample and they came back to this little laboratory in a little village in the middle of Cambodia and they actually mapped the arsenicosis levels of the river deltas throughout the entire country. Puppeteers were doing real hard science data collection.
Wow.
And I loved this guy. He was so creative, but this guy loved people and they loved him back. And so that was very special.
Yeah. How did you go from like working with this chemist to doing your own thing?
Well, he suddenly died of a heart attack in his early 40s. And at that time I was like, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to live with this guy. I want to be his underling. I want to do what he tells me to do. And I want to replicate his programs. And so when he was missing from the world, I was at a huge loss. Like that's where I saw my career going. I really wanted to make that shift. And so I dropped my agent back in USA. I got rid of the house, put all the belongings in storage and just started wandering. I talked to him a couple of weeks before he died and he was like, Darren, right now my passion is emergency housing because we had dealt with quite a few refugee situations. The two of us together had sort of also tackled other problems that were occurring in the area. And that was one of them. And so I started, well, okay, let me follow in his footsteps. Let me see what would he do? What would Mickey do? You know, I don't know. So I started to learn how to build alternative houses, like houses out of trash, houses out of like concrete domes, going to these classes and that sort of thing.
And this has nothing to do with puppetry. You're just doing this
nothing at all. I'm just like, I just want to make sure that, you know, I don't know. It was a big loss. I really thought that was important.
Sure.
But also at the same time, I'm doing stand-up comedy, taking classes with the Groundlings and with Upright Citizens Brigade in New York. And I'm taking stand-up classes and learning stuff. And so I'm still in this place where I'm doing comedy, also performing. Variety arts is what's paying the bills. You know, that actually pays well. Stand-up comedy doesn't.
Yeah.
And this cool thing happened. This guy came to me. His name was Kasambwe. He was an African comedian who'd come to America to study comedy. He was from Zambia. He was good. He was a real good stand-up comedian. Kasambwe goes, hey, Darren, will you teach me how to use puppets? And I was like, wait, what? If you know anything about stand-up comedians, that's no one makes the shift from stand-up to puppetry.
It's a real unusual request.
Well, yeah. And even in the clubs, like I never juggled in the clubs. I never did magic in the clubs. I never did puppetry. Like I understood the stigma that we have. And I love the art form of stand-up. When I was on the stage, I was just doing that. So to have another stand-up say, hey, I know you do puppets. Will you teach me? I was like, wait a minute. Why? Mm-hmm. And so Kasambwe, he said, I want to talk with you. Let's go meet. And so we met at the shopping mall, the Galleria Mall in Dallas. And he said, I want to learn puppets, Darren, because I want to do ventriloquism. Okay, but this is so strange. Why? And he goes, because, Darren, since I've come to the U.S. to study stand-up comedy in the last 6 years, 17 of my high school classmates have died of AIDS.
Oh, wow.
It's because we can't talk about it. we just can't talk about it. Like, I can't, you know, to talk about condoms. And he whispered and he covered his mouth when he said the word condom. And I go, because I'm like, did you just cover your mouth when you said condom? And he was like, yeah. I was like, you do a third show on a Saturday night at a nightclub. You can say anything you want. And he's like, this is different. We're sitting in a shopping mall. There's people around. Like, this is my culture. We can't do this. And I was like, oh my gosh. And he's like, I want to learn this so I can go back to Zambia and talk to people frankly about this taboo subject. And I was like, dude, I will teach you whatever you want to know. I got videos. I have a huge amount of experience with puppetry. At this point, I had taught 20,000 puppeteers around the world. It was no problem to just give Kasambwe everything he wanted. But Kasambwe was also really hustling and trying to make a living. And so a passion project wasn't really on his plate. And so even though he loved the idea, it was going to be hard for him just financially. Just all the logistics of trying something like that is not easy. Mm-hmm. And so I said, Kasambwe, do you mind if I just sort of follow your passion a little bit? Because I see what you're thinking, and I think I have an idea. Yeah. And he said, yes, absolutely, Darren, go for it. And so that's sort of how I got the path. And I found out from that scientist, Mickey, his wife, that he had started his work in Kenya. And I realized at that point it was time to make some decisions. So, John, here's what I did.
Yes.
Like I said, I put all my things in storage, got rid of the house. I was living out of my car. I was just trying to learn what I could about humanitarian work and following my mentor's footsteps or whatever. But I didn't really know exactly what I was going to do. So I made a list. I made a list of all the things that I enjoy doing. So I'm about 32 years old, debt free. I had my house paid off. My car is paid off. Everything was good. I had no responsibilities in terms of like owing anybody anything. I was truly completely free to do anything I wanted at that age, debt free. And so I made a list of all the things I like to do. And I made a list of all the things that I'm good at doing, which is not the same list. And then of all the things that I was good at, I went, well, you know what I like doing? I like teaching puppetry. I hadn't done that in a long time at this point. And I said, but I also know that I'm very good at it, because in terms of like the 10,000 hours, I had taught these classes for years and I'd taught 20,000 people. I know that was one of my greatest strengths.
Sure.
So I thought, okay, so if this is my greatest strength and I like to do it, teaching puppetry, what would be the best use of puppetry? And of course, that would be like saying uncomfortable things. A puppet is just really good at parsing things that you wouldn't normally be able to talk about in public. That's probably, in my view, its highest purpose, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's like not its highest purpose, but maybe what is especially unique about puppetry is it can say things that other people can't. Yeah. Even historically, who could criticize the king? But a puppet show, the king might invite the puppets to come perform for him, you know, and you could say those things to the king.
Yeah, because you can't execute a puppet.
Right. You can't. Because I think some of Jeff Dunham's puppets would have been killed by now.
You think so? Yeah.
You know,
I think some of them have.
Well, I remember the first time he was on the Carson show? And he Carson invited Jeff to sit on the couch. And the first thing he did was make fun of Ed Sullivan. And it was like, wow, the guts on this guy. But he didn't do it. The puppet did it.
Of course. He's not saying a thing.
So anyway, that permission slip to say these things is amazing. And so I thought, okay, so what permission slip is the toughest? What is the hardest thing to talk about? And I'm guessing in terms of like the most common problems, sexually transmitted disease is pretty high up there on the list of things that people don't really want to talk about.
Sure. And in every country, not just Cambodia. I mean, the US too.
Right now on this podcast, I don't really like to talk about sexually transmitted disease. It's not my favorite, but that's a great use of it. So I thought, okay, so what so I'm just doing the math. I'm just like, okay, so what has the greatest impact? Well, HIV and AIDS has the greatest impact. Okay, so where is that? Well, sub-Saharan Africa is where the prevalence is the highest. So I did all that arithmetic all the way down to there. Okay, so I guess I'm teaching puppetry to do HIV and AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. But also, as a good observer that my mentor sort of taught me, is like, you don't really go somewhere without being invited. I don't think it's right for us dudes from America who think they know it all to go solve someone else's problem.
Right.
Necessarily. That's kind of a weird ego thing.
You don't want to push your way into another country saying, here I am to save the world.
Yeah, right. That's not cool. And it's not ever what I want to do. But I had talked to Kasambwe. And so that idea was also in the back of my head about that same time. And I was overseas building a house out of trash. Those earth ships out of Arizona or New Mexico, they build houses out of tires.
Okay.
They were doing a build in Guatemala. And I had just built a dome in a little village in Belize. And we're headed over to Guatemala. And I got an email that said that my renters had bailed out on me. Now, at this time, I was debt-free, but I was living off of the rent from my house.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no, I'm in Central America and I need cash. They were supposed to pay last month and they haven't paid. So I got a little cafe somewhere in Guatemala and got onto internet and went to Craigslist, where I had already stored photos of my house on Craigslist in storage somewhere. I don't know how you do it now, but. And so I made a new ad that said, hey, I got a house for rent in Waxahachie, Texas. If you PayPal me first and last month's rent, I'll tell you where the keys are hidden.
Oh.
And it worked right away.
Because it sounds almost like a scam.
Right?
Send me money. I'll show you where the key is hidden.
Right. But the other guy thought the same thing. He thought, who would scam like this? This is high risk to give someone keys. I don't know. He also thought it was really weird. I don't know. It was just the strangest thing for on either side for him to trust me and him for me to trust him.
Yeah.
It worked. And it, within days I had a renter.
Wow.
And I said, hey, here's where the keys are. And then I said, I'll see you in a month or so when I get back to the USA. I get back to the USA and it was a Kenyan dude and his wife.
Oh, is that right?
House. Yeah. And they saw my email address because it said something about puppets in the email. They said, hey, what's with the puppets? So I started to explain to them and they go, oh, you just got to come to our country. I go back every 2 months or so. Come with me on my next trip. I'll introduce you to stakeholders, people who care about this sort of thing, places where you could, you know, get some work or whatever. And hey, you should do that because we would really love that. And I'm like, wow, that's my invitation. That's what I was waiting for.
That's destiny.
Yeah, it was really, really cool. Yeah, I went and then we began to take a real serious look and I started a 501c3 to sort of support it. And then I became a member of Rotary International, and the local Rotary Club in DeSoto was like, hey, we are with you all the way. We hear what you're saying. We understand the model. Let's figure out how to finance this and get you launched.
Wow.
That's how Project Hand Up sort of started. That's the easy story. There's also the hard story.
That's the short version. Well, it's so funny that so many things had to happen like they did for you to be where you are.
Yeah.
If any of those things, like your person not paying the rent on time, if he would have paid the rent on time, you may have just gone along your life just doing what you do.
Wow. Honestly, I've never looked at the silver lining. I still sort of resent that person. Okay. Time for me to now. John, you've just exercised this demon of me resenting my renter for bailing on me. I never, ever thought of that.
It's true. If it wasn't for your brother,
totally right.
If it wasn't for the guy bailing on the rent.
Yeah. Yeah. I see that guy on Facebook from time to time and I'm like, you still owe me. Like, how dare you? Know? No, you're right. You're totally right.
How do you get your groups that you perform for or that your puppeteers perform for?
Oh, how do we get the people?
Yeah.
Okay. So like if there's a school that we're going to, like how do we find them?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's sort of an interesting thing in that that's not hard. Everybody wants something for free. And so giving them a free show is not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Nairobi, we know the statistics. We know the neighborhoods. We know where prevalency is higher than others. And so what we tend to do is find a region and then we will actually just permeate the region. Like, so if there's a school of 1,000 children, we'll go to that school. But if across the street, there's a school for 25 children, we also go there. It's the same cost. It's the same expense, the same time. The numbers don't look great to stakeholders and donors. But the idea is that if we're teaching something like this, everyone in the neighborhood needs to know. Because like for little kids, we're not really teaching them about sex, right? So we're teaching them about teaching little boys about girls have autonomy. They have the right to say no. So we do like a show that's really basically about consent, because a lot of sexually transmitted disease really boils down to that issue. And so setting up good behavior and doing gender equality is also one of those elements. But imagine if you teach some of the boys in the neighborhood, but not all of them. Well, that's not useful in that way. So I choose the schools by choosing the area and then going everywhere in that area.
There's lots more show, and Darren has some hilarious stories coming up. But I'm so inspired by a story, I want to take a second to encourage you to help Darren help others. Make sure to go to Darren's website at projecthandup.org and click on the Get Involved button. He lists all sorts of ways you can help Darren's group make a difference. That's projecthandup.org. Now, on with the show.
When I came here, I believed that I was the first, and that, which is sort of an arrogant sort of thought. I thought, well, no one else is doing this. Turns out I just didn't find them. I don't know how it happened, but I never ran into the guys who actually have a long history of it. There was actually a man, Dr. Eric Kristall, who came to Kenya in the 70s, and in 1994 introduced puppetry to East Africa through Gary Friedman, a South African puppeteer who was doing puppets against apartheid. He started training. They developed a program here through a family planning in the private sector organization to do HIV and AIDS education with puppets in 1994. Up until then, there was no history of puppetry in this country. So through Rotary, though, now if you know anything about Rotary, you know that there's not a lot of puppeteers as Rotarians.
I don't know either way.
Rotarians are generally like, you know, the chief of police, the guy who owns the biggest shop on the corner, the former mayor, the fire chief, et cetera. They're usually the who's who of any given town,
yeah.
But usually a business owner. It just so happened that I happened to own a business making puppets at the time. And so they invited me in to be a member. It's quite unusual for an artist to be a Rotarian. Mm-hmm. And so I was sort of singular and alone in Rotary when it came to finding people with similar occupations until I came to Kenya. It turns out the past president of the Rotary Club of Nairobi was Dr. Eric Kristall, who was the one who brought puppetry to East Africa. And his final project before he retired, he saw my grant come across his desk and said, oh, I want to partner with those guys. I want to do this. And so my first project in Rotary that launched Project Hand Up was his last project in Rotary before he retired. His club, the Rotary Club of Nairobi, and my club, the Rotary Club of DeSoto, started this project together. He said, hey, by the way, if you're going to be over here doing this project, do you want to live at my place? And I was like, sure. Okay. I live in an artist village on the edge of the Nairobi National Park in a forest that his wife actually planted 40 years ago.
Wow.
It's filled with baboons, hyrax, and Sykes monkeys. We can see most of the animals from Nairobi National Park. We have all the big five except for elephants.
Mm.
I wish anyone could spend a day with me. Like even to get here this morning, I was on the back of a motorcycle going from my little forest all the way through the world's largest urban slum of Kibera. Uh-huh. All the way to this place. And so what I see from the back of this motorcycle is the most amazing things. I can't believe that. Kid puppeteer. Now I'm here.
What a life.
I think I'm a little bit of a loss for words right now because Dr. Eric Kristall actually passed away on Wednesday. He was the only one that I'd ever met in my life who understood the path and actually also walked it because he had done puppetry for development work specifically for HIV and AIDS here in East Africa. And he was actually one of the greatest men I ever met. I got to live with him and see him almost every single day for the last 4.5 years and just sit at his feet and listen because he actually was born in South Africa. And this guy, he actually marched with Dr. Luther King at Selma. He met Dr. King several times. He spoke on the dais with Malcolm X. He petitioned JFK to allow African Americans into the Peace Corps. He spoke with Dr. King a few weeks before he was assassinated. He helped elect the first African-American sheriff in the American South.
Wow.
He also initiated the protest, the teach-ins during the Vietnam War protests. He was on the Nuclear Disarmament Committee. It's the same committee that created the peace sign. You know, so he's a huge part of rights for people around the world. And then once he got tasked by the United Nations to come and help do family planning and development back in Africa in the 70s. Then in the early 90s, he went, you know what? We need to be more creative. And I think puppetry is the way to do this. He got back into doing theater. Mm-hmm. And so he brought the puppets. And so I sort of got to absorb as a second mentor, another really honorable and really good guy. So I'm actually planning his memorial, which will be in 2 weeks from yesterday.
Are you thinking about your own future without him? I mean, he seems to have been a mentor of yours throughout this entire process.
In terms of my future, I think I'm just going to keep pressing on and doing it even in his honor. He died on Wednesday. Oh. I took care of all the arrangements. I wrapped his body. I took him to the funeral part, the hospital and the funeral home, and I did all these things. And then the next day, there's a conference for child sexual abuse, and I was like, I got to go to this.
Yeah,
Eric would want me to continue on. Like, I mean, it's not going to be any fun. I'd kind of rather be home crying. The work's got to be done. And I can just hear Mickey and I can hear Eric in my head saying, hey, don't worry about us. Press on,
yeah.
Press on, keep doing this. Because ultimately, John, the reason I really wanted to come on the podcast, I secretly wanted to, someone suggested it, but I was like, oh, I hope they suggest the Variety Artist. I was like, I need to be on some podcasts. And Doug Shearer was like, oh, you need to be on a Variety Artist. And I said, oh, okay, good, good, good. It's because I just want to tell my colleagues out there, this art form is such an effective way to talk about science. Like oftentimes a lot of artists will use art for self-expression, political expression, or just for fun. And you can absolutely do that, but you can also really use these art forms to talk about tangible, life-saving, life-changing things in places where you wouldn't be able to talk about it otherwise. And you can do it in places where no one else is actually doing it at all. The alternative to talking about telling little boys about consent, the alternative to talking to girls about the risk behavior that can lead to cervical cancer, mm-hmm. or talking to the Maasai people about female genital mutilation, the alternatives are like brochures, billboards, community lectures, a video if they have it.
Yeah, and a lot of these things are, people don't read them, they don't look at them, or if they do, they've seen so much that it's overwhelming and it's not effective.
And the other thing, John, it would be arrogant of me to think that this is unique. It's not unique. It's been done forever. And lots of people have done it. But what I noticed is that a lot of it is done backwards. A lot of it is academics in the university system or whatever, seeing the value and going, we have to do this. So educators come in and they try to do show. And it's like, well, that's really hard. We all know that it took us 20 years just to be good enough to do 60 minutes on stage.
Right.
And to think that a professor is going to tell his students, like as a funded grant project for their university, to write a paper about the efficacy of edutainment and come in from that angle, they're not going to do that well.
Yeah.
Whereas we are pretty quick studies on the ins and outs of just about any subject. I find that comedians and entertainers, thoughtful people, inquisitive people, for us to adapt a university's curriculum and put it into a show is probably far more effective than the reverse. And that's what I saw, is I would read these papers and they would have in the conclusion, they would say, the audience was kind of the wrong age for what we were doing. And I was like, what? How could that be the problem? Yeah. That can never be the problem. You have to adjust on the fly. It doesn't matter what age they are. You change the vocabulary, this and that. Like it was like, I know how to do this.
That's right.
All of us Variety artists know how to communicate,
yeah.
But not a lot of guys that took it from this angle. Like for instance, John, like here's how I made the HIV and AIDS show. Mm-hmm. When I came in here, Eric's puppeteers had already been doing this for 20 years, a few of them. And they said, Darren, you do this the opposite of every other group. And I was like, wait, what do you mean? He says, usually a university will come in and they'll sit us down for a week and tell us all about the situation. And we'll just learn about the situation. So let's just take female genital mutilation. And they'll take that issue and they'll parse it and talk about it. Then the next week, they'll bring in the stakeholders to tell us about why we're doing this. And then the next week, we'll start writing, we'll break into groups, and then we'll discuss the issues and how we would discuss it in a village or in a community. And then a few of us take all that discussion, all those notes, and begin to write a script. And then after we write a script, we figure out how many characters are in it. Then the next couple of days, we start building some puppets. And then the next couple of days, we practice for the organizations like UNICEF or the Ford Foundation representatives or whatever foundations it is, and the university people who are handling it. And then we go out, and then we rehearse for a day.
Oh, we rehearse for a day.
And then we go out and perform. Yeah. And I'm like, what?
You're torturing me here.
Yeah. I was like, what? He says, Darren, when you came here, the first thing you said was, okay, put a puppet on your hand.
That's right.
And so when Dr. Kristol saw my grant, he goes, wait, how are you going to train everybody in 2 weeks? It's going to take 2 weeks just to build the puppets. And I was like, why would we build the puppets? There's professional puppet builders.
Yeah.
We can just buy the puppets. He goes, oh yeah, of course. He said, well, how are you going to write all those scripts? I said, those scripts have been pre-written. So here's what I actually did. I interviewed everybody who cared about HIV and AIDS, mm-hmm. whether it was the pastor or a mom and dad or a grandparent who was affected by it, or a pastor who had to talk to his congregation, a nurse who would nurse people. I talked to doctors who would prescribe medication. I talked to children living with HIV about how kids treat them. I talked to their caregivers and the heads of orphanages about what they deal with, and talked to people who have it. And so I talked to everyone who's sort of affected, and I just started making like a book.
Yeah.
Like, okay, this age group and this gender really cares about this. You know, this particular religion really cares about this. If they're Muslim, they really care about this. If they're Christian, they really care, you know, this is what everybody thinks everyone needs to hear. And I just sort of made like a 12-page book of just all those messages. And a lot of it overlaps and a lot of it already makes sense. But there's some specific cultural things that are important, right?
Yeah.
So then I went back to America and I gave it to the guys who wrote the McGruff the Crime Dog program.
Yeah.
So I gave them all the material and I said, let's do this. And so they wrote a couple drafts and I went through it with them, no problem. So we wrote all these puppet show scripts and that sort of thing. And then I took it and then I sent it to Hollywood. And a guy I know who wrote like The Secret Life of Pets and Hop, yeah, and Puss in Boots and those other ones for Illumination. He's also a punch up writer, and he just made the script funny. He just rewrote it and just put in punch lines, boom, 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 all this really great, you know, just tweaked it here and there, you know, made little rhymes and stuff and sort of interesting and made it Hollywood quality from the already good quality material for children. And then I said, forget it. Now I'm sending it to Nairobi, because I had actually immersed myself in the stand-up comedy community in Nairobi, which is actually thriving. It's actually quite big.
Oh.
And I said, stand-up comedians will do all translations. There'll be no academics. We'll touch this script. It's going to be stand-up comedians who know the people that they're serving. And those guys cared too. Those guys have all been affected by HIV and AIDS. So it was, sure, a no-brainer for them. So they went through it. And then I pre-recorded all the voices. I went into the studio. I hired one of the best producers in Nairobi, and I just got a bunch of comedians and celebrities and good guys to actually do the soundtrack. So the puppeteers could just do what puppeteers love, which is manipulation. They just love to just bit behind there, put their hand in the air, grab the rods, move this, move that. That's what they're best at. I told Eric at the time, I said, a guy who's a great puppet builder is not necessarily a great voice artist.
True.
And a guy who's a great costume maker is not necessarily a good writer.
Yeah.
Those are all very, very different skills. I'm just going to hire all the best people and let us do the work we all love to do and are best at. That's sort of the opposite of anyone else that I know of who's really approached it. Let's see what happens there if we have it pre-recorded. Then all the puppeteers don't have to know the target language perfectly, because we do this in Swahili, we do it in English, we can do it in vernacular languages. So imagine how many different puppeteers you'd have to hire if they did their own live voices.
Oh yeah, they would have to know it.
Yeah, and when I send them out on the field, like if they use live voices and live script or whatever, and they're not doing pre-recorded, I always say, like, if a guy has a fight with his wife the night before, and then the next morning he's got to do a gender equality show, I want to make sure he's saying the right thing. And if I'm going to do data collection, I need to know exactly what that guy said to know why it did or did not work.
How do you know whether something is effective or not?
Yeah. So that's the hugest question that everyone, of course, will have, who's especially a donor or a stakeholder or a funder. Something like gender equality is going to be measured in generations. We won't know. Something like hand washing, you know, you can tell real quick if a kid's figured it out. But what we can test for is, did you remember? And then the other thing is, I tell people, okay, here's how a stand-up comedian knows if he's effective. He knows immediately. The second he hits that punchline, oh, yeah, he knows if he's done it correctly or not. Like, the feedback is instantaneous. Not only do we have that, but we also have the attention span. I have kids and adults who will sit for 75 minutes in one show. And the boring stuff's kind of at the end. It's not perfectly at the end, but pretty close in terms of like the laughing scale, the way show order is built. A lot of the recap stuff is happening at the 62-minute mark, and they are wrapped with attention.
The first part of any show is getting people on your side.
Is this going to be good? Yeah. can I trust you with what's happening? Yeah. That's another way, is just the tension. Like, you know, they're paying attention for a very, very long time. And so there's qualitative feedback, which is like post-show interviews. I can give kids a before and after test, like ask them a series of questions about what they know about HIV and AIDS before the show and then after the show. And then we can go back 3 months later or 6 months later or a year later and ask the same kids the same questions and see if there's any retention done there.
Okay.
So in that way, you can find out if they memorize. But behavior change, it's trickier when it comes to behavior change, because again, it's like it's something you measure in a generation.
Is there any way to measure that over a 10-year span? Or, I mean, you've been doing this for quite a while now, right?
Yeah, we've been doing this for 5 years with this method right now.
So that's still a fairly short period of time.
Yeah, it really is. It's hard to say. The other thing is the puppeteers are really good at that I did not know about before I came here, is that they actually do what's the word for it? It's called participatory theater, where the puppeteers do use live microphones and they sort of act out scenarios and then put it back to the audience to say, and now what would you say? Mm. And then they redo the scenario with that suggestion from audience members. So now it's fully immersive and the audience is part of the show. And that's what they do for like civic education, to teach people their rights or what they know. That's what they might do for education about what you do in a family situation where you find out a daughter is pregnant and she's only 14. How's everyone going to react? And how does this make people react? They can go through scenarios together. So participatory theater is another sort of really interesting way where we actually can learn what the audience thinks. Mm-hmm. So some of these organizations can use us to collect information as opposed to giving information.
That is interesting. Now, you talked a lot about going to schools and kids and things. Is it just as effective with adults?
That's the crazy thing. Yes, absolutely. In fact, I would say more so, because I tell people, like, kids are kind of used to seeing new things. So they'll love it, but they saw something new a month ago too, because that's the virtue of growing up. You're always seeing something new. Okay. Whereas you get someone who's 70 years old and they see something new, they love it. Man, they love it. They say, do it again. The same thing. Yes, the same thing. Do it again right now.
Yeah.
You'll be out in a village and the grandmas are like, can you do a show just for us? Now, that's literally happened, where I've done a family show and the grandparents say, no, this is for us. We've never seen anything like this.
Oh, that's neat.
This is amazing. So that's really cool. And you know what's also interesting? That question you just asked me is like the number one question. I've been going through a lot of old Jim Henson material, like his old interviews and stuff. Same question they constantly asked him. This is for kids, right? And he's like, no, it's not for kids. It's literally the greatest for adults. Adults love the Muppet Show. The TV Guide called it the only adult TV show on the air.
Yeah, I used to watch that with my dad when I was a teenager, and he loved it just as much as I did.
Absolutely. But it's this constantly, that's the hard part for us, is like, will you please invest in our work? It's not just for kids.
Yeah.
It's not just silly. Please invest in our work. It's the same song and dance. And it's like, I see your faces when I did the demonstration. You obviously love it more than children do.
Yeah.
So they'll come to me just like they always have. Well, I'll bet all of us on the Variety Artist podcast listeners, we've all had the kids really liked your show.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You look out there and the parents are laughing and having a great time.
The parents are dying.
Yeah. Then afterwards they're like, oh, the kids really loved it. Wait a minute. Yeah,
like, stop it. Why do you got to phrase it like that? You loved it. Yeah. You were slapping your kid's knee and pointing, explaining the joke that you're laughing about. Yeah, man. It's sort of the age old thing, but it hurts a little bit more when your funding is wrapped around it.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, can't you just believe in me? Just trust this is working. I wouldn't put my life into it if it didn't.
All right. So normally we would do fact or something John just made up. And that's always this crazy part of my show. But today, because you gave me some really interesting facts, I'm going to do something a little different. We're going to do really interesting things about Darren. How about that?
You're going to change the whole show for me?
Yes. We're changing the entire show just for you.
Oh, man. Okay.
Okay. So here's what's going to happen. It's going to be kind of the same, but different. I'm going to give you a little headline. And it's obviously true because, you know, you gave them to me. And you're going to tell me about it. How's that sound?
It sounds like I messed up the instructions.
It's okay. But it's going to be really cool. All right, here we go.
Okay.
Darren was shipwrecked on a deserted island off the coast of Cambodia.
Yes.
You were shipwrecked on a deserted island?
Yeah.
What happened?
It was literally supposed to be a 3-hour tour, which is hilarious.
Is that true?
Yeah, I was with these sort of like missionary kids, and they were all sort of goofy. But I was tired. I'd been working in a refugee camp or something like that. But we decided to take a weekend off and just go be young people at the beach.
Yeah.
And they all decided they want to go on a tour. And I was like, all right, whatever. I didn't ask any questions. I wasn't involved at all.
You weren't suspicious when they said, it's a 3-hour tour. It's a 3-hour tour.
No, it should have been the first red flag.
Yeah, it should have been.
I will never claim to be intelligent. I don't make good decisions sometimes. Anyway, these guys, what was happening is all these boat operators kept saying no. And the guy in charge was like, what do you mean no? And they're like, there's too many waves. And he's like, oh, someone will do it. And so he kept asking more and more boat operators. And I wasn't paying attention at all. I just didn't care. I was sitting on the beach just eating. And then this little boy brought a little boat. And I realized later what was happening is everyone who had any experience was saying, no, it's not safe today. And this one boy who was like 14 was like, I need money. And so he took us. We got close to a little island off the horizon.
Wait, is that flag number two? You have a 14-year-old as your sea captain?
Again, I'm not paying attention. I'm on vacation from working at a refugee camp. Yeah, no. And that's actually when I made the rule. I said, from now on, I will not let someone else just randomly take control of my decisions like that. Because that was a bad thing. Because once we got to the boat, I'll skip a bunch of it. But yeah, that's when I decided I was going to start making more decisions in my life. Yeah. That's the most number of unexploded landmines in the world is in Cambodia. And so we got to the beach. I was like, we can't even go anywhere. We can't even move around. We shouldn't walk anywhere on this little island. It's not safe. And what tipped me off when I really realized how dumb of a situation it was, I said, hey, anybody got a phone? And they're like, no. I'm like, why didn't you bring your phones? Like, they're the only ones who live there or were there long enough to have like a SIM card and a local phone. I was like, why didn't you bring your phones? They're like, well, we didn't want to get them wet. I'm like, we have sandwiches and Ziploc bags. The same technology is possible with a cell phone. You've managed to plan to keep the sandwiches from getting wet. You couldn't apply that same technology? I don't know. So,
so it says you were shipwrecked. So were you stuck on the island for a while?
Yeah, we were. We got rescued the same day.
Oh, same day. Okay.
Yeah. The headline is better than the story. The crazy thing was these guys picked us up, and when it was the middle of it, it was like full moon. It was like by the light of the moon, we had to jump from one boat to another off of the shore. And I was getting electrocuted because the waves were hitting the battery box or whatever to the boat. And I was holding onto something metal. That it was electrocution and falling off boats and jumping from one boat to another at the same time. And then when we got there, I said, does anyone here even speak the local language? And this one girl goes, oh, I kind of do. And she came back and she goes, I just heard the boat captain on the CB radio. He said, either we have 6 Americans, how much can we get for them? Or he said, we have 6 Americans, how much can we get from them?
Yeah. Wait, is there an ending to this story? So you...
Well, I'm alive. No, dude, I'm telling you, John, I listen to your podcast. There's a lot of you guys who do not fully finish your stories. Okay. I have been wrapped with the tension where I'm like, what happens next? Did she vomit on the kid in front of her? Or did she vomit on the kid behind her? You know, I'm just like, what happened? And the guys just taper off with the stories. No, what happened was we got to the dock and they just said, wait here for the owner of the boat. And I finally, I said, guys, I'm making the decisions. We are not waiting here at all. This is scary. It's the middle of the night. We're in these random docks. We don't even know what city we're in. We're just getting together and we're running in a group as far and as fast as we can until we find some mode of transportation that we can get on and start heading back to a city we recognize. Mm. And so we took a bunch of money and shoved it in the kid's hand and ran. The Cambodians they just didn't stop us. They were not happy that we were running. It was like a Jackie Chan movie, like an action sequence on the docks of this Cambodian small town. It was so far from shore. We found locked gates on the edges of what's it called, where boats are all docked, that place.
The boat dock.
Yeah, man, you're so good at this. I'm grieving right now. My vocabulary is not catching up with my brain. Yeah, so we found a locked gate, and we ran and ran and ran, found another locked gate, and ran and ran and ran, and finally found a little hole in the fence, and ran out there and flagged down a motorcycle driver. And everyone was like, "We can't ride on the same motorcycles. Boys and girls are not allowed to be on the same motorcycle." I said, "Forget it. I'm in charge now. You go with him. You go with her. You go with him, and we all get on bikes and we go now." And so we all just took off out of there, and propriety be damned. We let boys and girls sit, because in Cambodia, you don't actually touch the other gender at all.
I'm sitting here sweating.
Really?
No.
Okay.
Too early to sweat. Early too cold.
Yeah, but that was a great story. Yeah, I tell that story from time to time with at great length. I try to turn it into like a 30-minute thing.
Yeah. That was good. All right, we're going to go to our next really interesting thing about Darren.
Okay.
Darren's office was shot up by police in Nairobi.
Yeah, man, that's the thing. It's hard here. I mean, I'm joking. I sound healthy. I feel good. It's a good place to live, like physically, but it's not a great place in terms of safety. Things are challenging. A lot of death. And one night, we actually left our office like at 5. The police were chasing some kidnappers or something, and they just riddled bullets through the building. And I came to work the next morning, and there was bullet holes and shells, and you know, at face height in our offices.
And how did you even find out what had happened?
Well, the stories get around. I mean, it really got around. Eventually, everyone pieced it together. But it was kidnappers who were cops set up by other cops, so they could go specifically kill those bad cops without having to go through the justice system.
Wow.
So it was a series of setups and intentionally trying to kill these guys.
Wow.
And that's the story that got back to us.
So do you just go back to work? You just go back in your office and you're like, well, here we go. Another day, another dollar.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, our first producer who did the, who did a song for us, he was right when we were just getting ready to come back to the country. Cause I'd gone back and forth to USA a few times. About a week before I came back, he was murdered on his way home.
Oh.
You know, and it's just like, man, that was our studio producer. He just went home a little too late, you know, wrong place, wrong time.
So tomorrow when I'm going to Facebook message you, you better return my Facebook message.
I'll be fine.
All right. The final really interesting thing. Well, there's probably lots of really interesting things about Darren, but the final one that I have here, Darren's last gig in Bogota. How do you say that?
Bogota
was canceled because guerrillas bombed his hotel weeks before his arrival.
Yeah. I remember we were invited by this company to do a giant puppet show with like robotic puppets as a alternative to Halloween. Their claim was that in Bogota on Halloween, there's a lot of kidnapping. So this church wanted to get a bunch of kids together and feed them and just keep them in a safe place for many, 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 many hours. Mm-hmm. And so we were on that crew. Just before we were buying the tickets, the hotel blew up.
Oh,
and they're like, oh yeah, gorillas like attacked that, and not the animal, but
the
freedom fighters. They blew the place up, and I was like, they just blew it up. Our show was 3 weeks away, and they're like, yeah. I'm like, that's the best time to go. If a Taco Bell on Third Street has food poisoning outbreak on Monday, the next 2 weeks are the best days to go to the Taco Bell on Third Street. They cannot afford that to happen twice in a row.
Have you seen the movie The World According to Garp?
No.
Okay. There's this movie called The World According to Garp. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. So okay. Robin Williams is standing there with his wife and they're looking at a beautiful house they're about to buy. And they're saying, oh, there's 4 bedrooms and it's beautiful. This bedroom's beautiful. And the bathroom, whatever. A little 2-seater airplane comes flying in and totally destroys the house. Just crashes into the house. And Robin Williams says, we'll take it. and the realtor looks at him and says, what do you mean you'll take it? An airplane just crashed in the house. He goes, what are the chances of that happening again?
Okay. So my point of view is not without precedent.
No.
That's great. Yeah. My other favorite memory of those trips to Bogota was, I remember the first day we went, I went with, I don't know if you know him, but Chaggy the Clown. He's a Puerto Rican guy who's a great, great performing artist.
Okay.
He was with us and he got into the hotel room before I did. And I go, Chaggy, his English is really broken, especially back then. But I said, how are the beds? And he goes,
What?
I was like, that's the perfect description for a bed I've ever heard. He was saying, like the Flintstones, it was hard. It was a hard bed. He couldn't come up with the right words real quickly, so he just did the Flintstones theme song.
Thanks for helping me out with that.
Yeah, I got it right away, but I guess I speak clown.
Yeah. Now, before I let you go, how can somebody get involved in Project Hand Up?
I hope they've made it this far.
Oh.
If you've made it this far, basically right now, projecthandup.org is where I'd like you to go. And I'd like you to click on the Patreon link, because we finally decided, after all these years of just pushing and pushing and pushing and fundraising, that we've never really taken the time to say, hey, we need a hand up. These puppeteers, there's 10 of them. I'm now responsible for, you know, just keeping guys employed. If I can't keep them employed, they will have to hustle and find other work if I can't keep them busy all the time. And it's very, very difficult here. So I would really, in my dream, it'd be like, oh, I wish every juggler, puppeteer, magician, stand-up comedian, and a school assembly performer would give $2, just solidarity, or $5 or whatever. Just go to Patreon and say, we believe in what you're doing. We want you to keep doing it. Take heart. Here's some money. You can repair those windows if the police shut up. Here's some money. You can, when your battery backup fails, you can buy another one. Here's some money so your puppeteers can at least buy into government insurance, you know, and have something going for them and make something of themselves. Because we are actually prepared to be $250,000 company right now without a year, without having to make any other changes. Like, we have the equipment, we have the personnel, we have what it takes. We just don't have that money. So right now, John, all we do is wait for someone else to believe in what we believe in and give us a project. But we are prepared to do that without anyone else. We don't need a sending organization. We know what our communities need, and we can provide that, and we can do it in different languages, but we do need that money. So my greatest hope would that people would go to patreon.com/projecthandup, or go to Patreon, or go to projecthandup.org and just click on the link there. It's pretty obvious, but it says, get involved. And the get involved link says, go to our Patreon page. There's even a Patreon link in the upper right-hand corner of projecthandup.org, and just pledge monthly. And if we had a monthly income we can depend on, then I go, okay, I can budget this. I know how much guys can get paid. I know how much work we can do. I know how many lives we can affect. This is really life-changing stuff. So I guess that's the answer.
Well, thanks for joining me today, Darren. This was awesome. You're doing awesome work.
Thanks for having me. And any one of you guys who ever wants to come out and teach or be involved, you absolutely can come visit. I have a cottage for you. I can plug you into field work. I can plug you into work behind the scenes. If you want to just take a bit out of your career, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, and help out, I can make all the arrangements and it will be safe.
If someone wants to do that, how can they get a hold of you?
Project Hand Up. The email address is there. You can find us on Facebook. I handle all of it, so I will see it. Or if I don't, Veronica will. This is real. I've had jugglers come out here. I've had puppeteers come out here. I've had clowns come out here. Yeah, there's a place for you, for sure. And I can let you meet baby elephants and giraffe and all kinds of cool stuff.
You know what? Would you mind if I put your personal contact information, or the information that you're giving me, on your show notes? Or on the Variety Arts
absolutely. Page? Yeah, just Darren at projecthandup.org.
Okay.
Yeah, my email address, that would be great.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll just make it easier for folks that want to get involved. All right, thanks, Darren. That was great. And thanks to all my Variety artists. And tell your friends all about the Variety Arts podcast and all about Darren's project. Thanks again for hanging out. Now go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.
That's all for this episode of The Variety Artist, but your journey continues on our website. Go to thevarietyartist.com for more strategies, insight, and resources, as well as show notes on today's guest to assist you in your career. We'll see you on the next episode of The Variety Artist, but until then, go out and book those gigs, make some money, and have some fun.